Good evening, everyone.
It's a good
welcome.
Story.
My name is Gary White. I'm the Associate University Chaplain, and I'd like to welcome you to this evening's event. The volume has to be somewhat, I have to speak into it. I can't turn the volume up because we'll get feedback on that. First things first, if you have a cell phone or a pager, please silence them. Thank you. Before we begin tonight, I want to tell you about a program that's going to happen tomorrow night. It's rather unique. It's called Voices of the Living. It's part of the Project Dialogue series, which is examining crime and the ultimate punishment this year. And it begins at 6 o'clock in Surratt Cinema with film Eileen Wuornos, Life and Death of the Serial Killer. Eileen Wuornos was put to death in 2002 for killing 7 men in Florida. The film Monster had Charlize Theron, and it is based on Eileen Wuornos. And after this film is over at 7:30, we're going to have a roundtable discussion, 3 individuals. 2 of those 3 lost their loved ones to violent murder. And the third is the sister of Robert Glenn Coe, who was executed by the state of Tennessee in 2000. And so it's a rare opportunity to get this kind of roundtable discussion anywhere. So we're very lucky to have it here at Vanderbilt. And it's free and open to the public. I invite everyone to come. But here's tonight. First things first. It gives me pleasure to introduce to you Amanda Mitchell, the president of Vanderbilt's Interfaith Council.
Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone tonight to our panel on Forbidden Images and the Free Press. I first wanted to give you a brief introduction into what the Vanderbilt Interfaith Council does. We are a group of representatives from various religious faiths on campus, and we come together to try to talk and to create dialogue between religious groups on campus so that, at least on a local level, we can try to understand each other while still remaining strong in our own faiths. But tonight, I'd like to introduce our moderator for our panel. She is the University Chaplain at Vanderbilt. Her name is Gay Welch.
Articulate spokesmen on behalf of their own positions. I'd like to introduce our panelists in alphabetical order, and the plan is, after I introduce each one, that they will each give you a brief presentation on their position on the issue of the cartoons and the response thereto. And after that, I will pose a few questions to the panel as a group, and then we'll open it up to interaction with you. So our panelists are, for the evening, Nod. Bruce Berry is a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt, and in his life outside the university is president of the board of the American Civil Liberties Union of Tennessee. He teaches a course in the sociology department on media and culture, and is currently writing a book about free speech in and around the workplace. Dr. Awad Bin Hazim is a professor at Meharry Medical College, adjunct professor at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and Tennessee State University, director of outreach for the Islamic Center of Nashville, Muslim chaplain in the office of the university chaplain, and advisor to the Muslim Student Association at Vanderbilt. Thomas McCoy is professor of constitutional law at Vanderbilt, specializing in the First Amendment, which covers freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and free exercise of religion. John Siegenthaler founded the First Amendment Center in 1991, mission of creating national discussion, dialogue, and debate about First Amendment rights and values. He's former president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. He was for 43 years a journalist for the Tennessean, National Morning Newspaper, and at his retirement, he was editor, publisher, and chief executive officer of that publication. I'd like to turn the program over now to our panelists, and go.
Okay. Sound okay? Okay. Thanks, Gay, and it's delightful to be on the panel with these wonderful gentlemen. In October, shortly after these cartoons appeared originally in the Danish newspaper Jyllandsposten, a bunch of diplomats from several Islamic countries wrote to Denmark's Prime Minister Rasmussen. In a letter, they said the Danish press should not be allowed to abuse Islam in the name of democracy, freedom of expression, and human rights. And they went on to say in this letter, "We urge Your Excellency's government to take all those responsible to task under the law of the land in the interest of interfaith harmony and Denmark's relations with the Muslim world. And in fact, there are a couple of provisions in Denmark's criminal code that maybe kind of sort of could have been relevant, one having to do with publicly ridiculing or insulting the dogmas of a religious community, one having to do with insults aimed at the race, color, national, ethnical the roots of an individual. But a prosecutor in Denmark decided soon after that the cartoons constituted no criminal offense under these laws. But I mention this because seeking out government repression is a common but, in my opinion, poor response to a provocation that arises from material that's published by a free press. Unpopular ideas have often drawn the brunt of repression. Here in the U.S., it was really as recently, I would argue recently, as World War I, when it was, you could be jailed just for putting out anti-war leaflets. Modern First Amendment law in this country evolved out of those times, and many struggles in many cases later. Ours is one of the most speech-protective countries in the world. It doesn't mean that all speech is protected. And in fact, it was about 35 years ago that the Supreme Court said that speech can be suppressed only if it's intended and likely to produce imminent lawless action. The point, though, is that explosive content cannot be used as a means to justify the censorship of ideas, the expression of ideas, or censoring a free press. Does publishing anti-Muslim cartoons pose vexing problems for democracy? You bet. That's the price, I would argue, of a free and open society. Given current contexts as diverse as war, terrorism, racial profiling, detainee rights, secret prisons, selective enforcement of immigration laws, we certainly shouldn't, and I certainly don't, minimize the mistreatment and scapegoating of Muslims, Arabs, Asians, others in the U.S. and elsewhere in the West. But however any of us chooses to frame the narrative of the global agitation that was catalyzed by the publication of these cartoons, it's apparent to me anyway that the issues go far beyond the editorial judgments of a single Danish newspaper. News organizations censor themselves every day in the name of civility, community harmony, and good business. People who are offended by what they find in the press can protest in many ways, with their feet, their voices, their eyes, their ears, their wallets, their on-off switches, their paper shredders, and even their votes. But even if the press has an obligation, moral, commercial, or both, not to insult people gratuitously, people in a free society, I would claim, do not have the right not to be insulted. So when understandably upset critics, like the authors of that letter to the Danish Prime Minister last fall, when these critics were understandably upset, say that the press should not be allowed to abuse Islam in the name of democracy and freedom of expression, I argue that they sadly miss the point. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, in an important free speech case about 55 years ago, wrote that full and free discussion, even of ideas that we hate, encourages the testing of our own prejudices and preconceptions. That's a hard thing to do, but my assertion here is that the remedy for offensive speech is more speech, not less. The remedy is to answer it, not to censor.
Good evening, everyone, and I also greet you with the greetings of peace, the greetings of Islam. Now, all of us know the controversy that continues to provoke a spectrum of responses throughout the globe, and that is still quite alive and ongoing. Many of us also know by now that it is against Islamic principles to represent imagery not only of the Prophet Muhammad, to whom be peace, but really all the prophets, whether it's Jesus, Moses, and all the other lines of prophets. And also religion in the Muslim world, as we have also understood by now, is not something to ridicule, whether Islam or anybody else's religion. So for these reasons, the cartoons are seen by Muslims, and not just by radicals, as a transgression against something that is sacred, and also as a provocation against Islam. Therefore, Muslims are disturbed and certainly troubled by such insensitive and deliberate acts of hatred in the newspapers under the guise of free speech. Muslims do not consider the publication of these cartoons as free speech. Instead, they consider this as hate speech and really irresponsible and sensational journalism. They also consider these as deliberate acts of inciting an already angry population in the world. However, Islam also dictates prudence in such matters. In the Islamic tradition, there are a number of instances that the Prophet of Islam, having the opportunity to strike back at those who attacked and vilified him, but instead, his response was restraint and compassion and education as well. This is why God refers to him in the Quran in specific terms, and he refers to him as the Prophet, as a mercy of the world. Many Muslims aspire to capture this very idea and be a living example of the Prophet Muhammad. So as we gather here today to dialogue and to debate about this, I also need for you to remember that 99.9% of the 1.5 billion Muslims did not take to the streets and did not burn cars or destroy property, but in their hearts they are filled with anguish because of the vilification of their Prophet. Humiliating the Prophet of Islam is to humiliate the very heart of Islam, and is to humiliate in that regard, certainly, every Muslim that is on this planet. It is these Muslims who protest silently in their hearts and who are deeply troubled, on the one hand, by the demeaning cartoons, but also, on the other hand, by the Muslims who are out there reinforcing the stereotypes. The voice of these 99% Muslims has legitimate concerns, even if they don't share the views of free expression and free press. These majority Muslims, they want a platform that promotes tolerance and coexistence in a pluralistic world. So any inflammatory expression and hate speech only causes dissension and closes the doors of this dialogue and the debate and intellectual and that cross-fertilization of ideas, the cultural exchange of ideas. And on the other hand, respect, tolerance, and sensitivity is what will foster bridges of understanding. Thank you.
Well, what I would like to do is just offer you four separate points as sort of food for thought. And at least two of these four points have already been touched on by previous comments. The first of the points is that these cartoons would be, in the United States, absolutely protected by the free speech clause of the First Amendment. There's no ambiguity about that. No matter how offensive, no matter how hateful, no matter how obnoxious, they would be absolutely protected from any governmental interference. Examples of similar incidents that produced this kind of absolute protection would be the Nazi march in Skokie, a Jewish suburb of Chicago, absolutely protected. Klan rallies across the United States, Klan rallies that produce hateful speech, absolutely protected. And interestingly, and I guess ironically, in the United States where these cartoons would be absolutely protected, you actually haven't seen very much by way of publication of these cartoons. Second point. In Europe, on the other hand, the major countries of Europe are actually in a very awkward position on this, particularly France and Germany. They do not actually have unlimited free speech in France and Germany. The French government and the German government are in the business of suppressing speech that they consider sufficiently obnoxious, sufficiently offensive. There are cases in both France and Germany where Nazi speech, or where anti-Holocaust speech, or where in France even speech against Islamic immigration into France has been punished with criminal sanctions. So those countries actually are in the business of punishing what they consider offensive or obnoxious speech. And in that context, it seems reasonable for the Muslim community to demand the same sort of protection for what they consider truly obnoxious speech. The third point I would offer you is that there does, in fact, seem to be a terrible irony operative here. It seems to me, as best I can tell, that the point of at least several of these cartoons was a critique or even a ridicule of a particular version of Islam that invokes Allah and the Prophet Muhammad to justify violence, killing, terrorism. certainly a legitimate criticism of that version of Islam. And the response of thousands and thousands of Muslims around the world has simply reinforced or validated the critique of the author of the cartoons. And finally, the fourth point that I would offer you as food for thought is that this again seems to me to be another example which demonstrates the basic truth that the mixture of religion and politics is always a formula for disaster. We've seen it now recently in the Muslim Middle East. I think we see it in Israel. I think we've seen it in Bosnia. We've seen it in Ireland, Northern Ireland particularly. And we periodically see it in smaller ways in the United States. The mixture of religion and politics is a formula for disaster. And the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment is what largely protects us from that in the United States, but does not protect us completely, because there are large segments of the population that simply do not agree with the separation of government and religion. Four items as food for thought.
I would simply add very briefly, I think most of the points I would make have been made by my three colleagues, and I subscribe to almost everything I've heard. It strikes me that as a journalist, I should speak to this tradition of political cartooning in our country, and it is without question that its history is one of offense. Political cartoons are by nature designed to cause pain, to injure feelings, to hurt. Jeff McNally, a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist who's now syndicated, said, somewhat in jest, I'm sure, if it weren't that we were political cartoonists, my guess is we would be hired assassins. When he said it, it might have drawn a humorous response. In the context of this discussion, it's very serious indeed. But if you look at the history of political cartoons in this country, they have not all been political. Indeed, many of them have been attacks on religious institutions. And I went back through books of cartoons this morning and found that McNally and Conrad of the Los Angeles Times and Grant Hamilton of Judge, Bill Malden, who was with the Chicago Sun-Times, and Brian Campbell Fisher of Puck, and Jules Pfeiffer, who was another syndicated columnist, and Herblock at the Washington Post, and Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury, and most of all Thomas Nast of Harper's Weekly, all at one time or another found religion to attack through outrageous depictions. And Catholics and Mormons, Nast in one of his most famous cartoons had the United States Capitol, and on one side a vicious animal gnawing away at the roots of the Capitol, another vicious animal gnawing away at the roots of the Capitol. That depiction listed one animal as Roman Catholic, the other as Mormons, and the caption was, "Eating away at religious liberty." More recently, you may remember a religious parody carried in Hustler magazine, published by Larry Flint, which described Jerry Falwell, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, not a prophet to me, but to prophet in many minds in this country, describing Jerry Falwell in the most outrageous terms you could ever imagine. No one has ever written anything on an outhouse wall as vicious and as demeaning as those words that described Jerry Falwell. It had to do with his sex life. It had to do with his sobriety. It had to do with his mother. It had to do with his sexual orientation. It is a vicious, outrageous attack. And he went to court to sue Larry Flynt of Hustler magazine. And the case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where the most conservative of our justices at the time, William Rehnquist, compared that attack to a political cartoon. In language that is specific, he draws the analogy between Hustler's parody of Falwell and the political cartoons that have been part of our history, specifically mentions NAST as the nastiest but perhaps the greatest of all our cartoonists, and concludes, despite the fact that a jury had given Falwell a monetary judgment of hundreds of thousands of dollars, Justice Rehnquist, this conservative member of our Supreme Court of late, Justice Rehnquist finds it is indeed protected speech. The difficulty we face today not only is that the clash of cultures exists, but it comes at a time when there is so little effort to reach across the lines that separate us in a time of violence and a time of war. And it seems to me that the cartoons coming at this time really make a difficult time more perilous. There is no one, I hear, in our government, in our religious institutions, in our business institutions, really seeking to reach across those cultural religious lines that divide us so dangerously today. And I'd simply conclude by saying that thinking of what we see on our television screens all around the world reminds us only that our president's democratization of the Middle East has a long way to go before there's going to be anything close to comity between people of religious faiths who are really divided by a chasm of disenchantment and disorder.
Thank you much for your remarks. You've said a lot. In most ways, you've said everything I would have raised in my three profound questions to each of you. But in order to prepare myself to address this issue, I actually went to the newspapers, John, and sort of came up with three focus issues that seemed to me to be worth expanding on a little bit. The first, in a column that was a guest commentary in the Tennessean very recently, and the title of it was "Islam Cartoon Isn't About Free Press, It's About Hatred." So that raised for me the issue of what is the difference between free speech and hate speech. And the writer of this column says, "The publication of this offensive cartoon and others is not free speech. It's irresponsible journalism and quite possibly hate speech. Even non-Muslim journalists and cartoonists should be appalled by such sensational and deliberate acts of inciting an already angry population in the world." It's issue number one, the difference between hate speech and free speech. Issue number two came from an op-ed piece in the Tennessean Today about other violent acts, in which the author asks what is the appropriate moral response by a group of people who have been offended, whose beliefs have been trampled on, who feel that they have been assaulted. And she ends up comparing the response of that small percentage that Dr. Benhousing referred to. What do people do when they are outraged and offended beyond measure? And she actually compares it to the United States engineering the Iraqi war, and says that we in America have become conditioned to accept some actions of our government and military that are, in a basic sense, heinous, and says that sometimes what people do when they are outraged and angered is more offensive if it's a group that we already have stereotyped as riotous and violent, when in fact our own government seems to her to have over-responded in much the same way. Finally, the third issue came from a piece that someone sent me, actually quite providentially, called Why I Published Those Cartoons by Fleming Rose of the Jyllands-Posten, the newspaper that initially published the cartoons. And he says, in a piece defending his actions, written just last week, that he commissioned the cartoons because of response to several incidents of what he calls self-censorship among journalists and other writers in Europe. And he wanted to challenge, among others, moderate Muslims to speak out. And so he decided, in his own words, to do it by adopting the well-known journalistic principle, show, don't tell. He wrote to members of the Association of Danish Cartoonists, asking them, quote, to draw Muhammad as you see him. He said he did not ask them to make fun of the prophet. 12 out of 25 active members of this group responded. And he says, did we insult and disrespect Islam? He said he certainly did not intend to. But what does respect mean, he asks. When I visit a mosque, I show my respect by taking off my shoes. I follow the customs just as I do in a church, synagogue, or other holy place. But if a believer demands that I, as a non-believer, observe his taboos in the public domain, he is not asking for my respect, but for my submission, and that is incompatible with the secular democracy. He goes on to say that there's been quite a public dialogue in Denmark. He goes on to say that he did not expect the violent response to what had happened. And he ends by quoting a Somali-born Dutch politician who says that the integration of Muslims into European societies has been sped up by 300 years due to the cartoons, making the point that it's going to play out differently in those cultures and countries with a history of free speech and protected speech and free press than it is going to be in those countries and cultures that did not have that. So having said that, I ask you, the difference between hate speech and free speech, what would an appropriate response be to offensive cartoons? And finally, sort of, what would you, if you were the journalist in question, advise this man to have done, ethically speaking? And I ask you all that. John, let's start with you.
Well, Tom, you're the best on hate speech and
free speech. Well, I'd like to respond to that one. Free speech is the absolute right to engage in hate speech. That's what free speech is. It is only hate speech, it's only obnoxious speech, it's only offensive speech that needs free speech. If it's not offensive, if it's not obnoxious, if it's not detestable, it doesn't need the protection of the First Amendment and free speech. And again, I cite you my examples from the American experience, the speech of the Ku Klux Klan or the speech of the American Nazi Party. They are as offensive as they can possibly be to segments of the American population, and those are the cases that test our commitment to free speech. Free speech is the right to engage in hate speech.
Is that absolute, or are there any limits?
It is absolute.
Nothing falls outside of that. Nothing is so bad as to be censorable.
That is correct.
Just going to be clear.
So can I ask you? So I mean, courts have said, Tom, that there are limits in terms of speech that would incite imminent and is intended to incite imminent intended violence or violent reaction.
And it requires one more characteristic to fall outside the protection. It must be advocating
right. Imminent
lawless action. If it incites lawless action from those who are hostile to the speaker's viewpoint, it is still absolutely protected. So it is not protected if it is explicit advocacy of immediate law-breaking.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I just wanted to add something very quick to that, which is it's not to say, I mean, I agree completely, but it's not to say that institutions haven't attempted to draw a distinction between free speech and hate speech. I think the courts have generally held that that's problematic in the public domain, but private institutions, private universities, Vanderbilt's not one of them, but private universities, for example, have sometimes tried to carve out hate speech codes and to say, well, there's free speech, but then there's speech that's disallowed. My view, and I should sort of put on my ACLU hat and say the ACLU's view, is that those codes are doomed to fail. They're doomed to be problematic because the line is impossible to draw in a way that such a thing can be reasonably enforced.
You want to say what you would do if you were a journalist before I say what what I wouldn't do?
Since you're the expert journalist, I'll let you go first.
All right, fine. I think all of us who have been journalists have asked ourselves over and over and over during this time, what would you do about running these cartoons as they are? How do you explain to an American, to a U.S. audience, what this is about if you can't show the cartoons? Now, there'll be disagreements in this room, perhaps between us about this. My guess is that the best speech in response to this hate speech, and it clearly is hate speech, and the depiction of the prophet with a bomb on his head, clearly offensive hate speech. But in my judgment, the best response to that depiction in this country would be to run that depiction and to accompany it on the editorial page with an editorial that attacked it. I remember once, we were all challenged at one time or another to publish something that so directly offends us. I remember the Ku Klux Klan came in one day with a recruiting ad. And they said, you know, you believe in free speech, you believe in free press. Here's our ad, here's our money. And I ran it, but on that day I ran an editorial and an editorial cartoon attacking that ad, calling attention to it and attacking it. I think, in my view, and the Philadelphia Inquirer is one of the few papers I know that followed this course, in my view, those depictions will so outrage many Americans. Those depictions would give people of faith, preachers of faith, to stand in the pulpit and make clear how they are outraged by those depictions. And I sometimes think that we draw away from words that we see that are offensive to others because we're imbued with a sense of political correctness. I think it's new, novel in this generation, and it's not part of our history and part of our tradition. I know what I'm suggesting to you is going to be controversial with many of you. Say, well, I certainly wouldn't do that. It's in terrible taste. It's making a bad situation worse. You may have outbreaks on the streets of our city or New York City or some other city where there are concentrations of Muslims. But I do believe that the one thing that's lacking in many newspapers today is a sense of outrage over what has happened here. And I think that part of the reason for that is most editors haven't seen the cartoons, don't have any sense of what they're about. Nor do their readers. They see these scenes on television of the riots and the flames and the flag burning, which Tom will tell you is an honored
absolutely
First Amendment
protected
tradition, flag burning. But they see that and they say, oh, the Muslims are at it again, that violent religion. Well, you know, they're upset, they're outraged, they're angry. We have violence in this country. And we all know it. You know, I think that we backed away from this issue rather than addressing it. And what I say may offend you, but I believe in this country, we would understand better and that there would be a more positive response if people knew what this is all about, and they don't know now.
And could I add that most people don't understand what it is about the depiction of the prophet that is offensive.
That's right.
The particular reason within Islam that
which,
it is offensive.
Which brings me to my point that I think there is a need to educate the people a lot, obviously about, for example, the offensive nature of these cartoons, why that is the case, the imagery of the prophet, prohibition in Islam. But also I must disagree with you, the fact that encouraging the idea that these cartoons should be published, but then counteract that with a commentary to perhaps critique the cartoons in a positive way, not in a negative way.
Because I think condemn them.
Oh, condemn them. But I think what that will do is it will only incite more and more that distance of the gap that is already there in this angry population, so to speak. What also astonishes me is that Muslims in Europe, and they're quite a large number in France, we know they reach almost 5 million, many of them first generation, born and raised there. But because of the social issues that face them, the marginalization that has taken place of this, I mean, they grow up in a society knowing that there is free speech and free press. And some of the scholars in Europe, Tariq Ramadan and others, you know, of Islam, have come out to say that Muslims also need to recognize that they do live in countries where there's this idea of free speech. And they need to know that as long as they live in those countries, they're supposed to come to some sort of an appreciation or an understanding that this is the norms in that country. And they should not overreact in the manner that they have overreacted. So then that brings me to the other point. So obviously there has to be reasons why people are overreacting. And if you look carefully at where this is happening in the world, and so it sort of goes back to that moral response, or what is the response. If you look at what is happening worldwide, you'll see that a lot of times these are the poorest of the poor, the marginalized of society, who are literally just waiting for something to happen, and in a mob-type environment, they get out and they just vent their anger in this really irresponsible way and very vengeful way of destroying property and so on. And so there are issues underlying this, and there are undercurrents to all this. There are some political ramifications, the aristocratic governments of the Muslim world, they're supported by the Western powers of these aristocratic governments, you know. All these, add to the complexity of the problem, and it's not just the cartoon has been used as a way to come out to vent anger from this group that I'm saying is the poorest of the poor. But really, the majority of the Muslims have not done that. But if you talk to them one on one, you sit with them, you dialogue with them, they will automatically, first thing they'll tell you, they're angry about it, they do not agree with that idea. Free speech is whatever we want to give it, whatever name we want to call it. To them, it is hate speech, and they draw a line between that and what is free speech. Also, the fact that Muslims are a significant number in the Western world now, not as in the past. You know, we're talking of 10 million in the U.S., 5 million in France, almost 2 to 3 million in England alone. And so these are growing numbers of a large portion of what they call disadvantaged groups, you know, minority groups, religious groups, such as Muslims. But one needs to understand that there has to be certain sensitivity, and to sort of accommodate that free speech, to sort of adjust to that. And the idea that Germany and France and Austria has laws against vilifying religious icons and in Judaism and Jews and the Nazi movement or whatever it is. So all that again, lends us to the point that within the European context, there is an understanding of what this free speech is and what it can cross over to be hate speech.
I'd like to open it up now. We have a few minutes left for people in the audience to address a question to any of the panelists in particular. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd just like somebody to speak to the influence on the world community that Imam Abu Labba had when he put a portfolio of these cartoons together. country to country, I'm talking about Muslim countries, and shared the portfolio with them. What happened after that, and who instigated what?
I don't think I can sort out the facts, but I want to say two things about that. It's pretty clear that the reaction in Denmark in the period following the original publication of the cartoons by Jyllands-Posten was a lot more tempered. If to read the piece that Gay Welch referred to by Fleming Rose, the culture editor of the paper, that piece appeared in Sunday's Washington Post, easily findable on the web and highly worthwhile. To hear him tell it, the cartoons produced a constructive sense of dialogue around all this in Denmark. I don't know if that was true. I haven't been reading the Danish press. I think you have to be able to read,
don't read Danish.
Yeah. But it is clear from what we know that some involved in this tried to make more political hay than came out of Denmark originally. It's also pretty clear that other European newspapers chose to sort of jump on this in their own way. And I was actually interested to hear John Siegenthaler say whether he sort of viewed the European newspapers' role in this the same way that the American newspapers might have been in covering this. So that gives me an opportunity to stop talking and ask him that question.
Which question?
Well, the European papers that during the fall, sort of in either solidarity with the Danish paper or just saying, we stand for free speech too, and we're going to publish these things. What do you think about their
action? I think it's a knee-jerk reaction that pervades much of the press in the Western world. You challenge us, and we'll show you. We'll just do it. But I think a more reasoned approach, I think the papers in this country have shown a more reasoned approach. I've already said that what I think I would do if I were still about it, I'd try as best I could to help the readers understand. And as I say, I think I'd try to use the editorial page as a forum to promote that understanding. Unlike papers in Europe, papers in this country, for the most part, have been politically correct and bowed. Online, it's a much different world online. Some of the comments online have been about as outrageous as the cartoons themselves. Of course, that's unregulated speech online. They're, you know, and much of it's anonymous. But my sense of it is, you know, journalists are supposed to be citizens too. And citizenship at times requires a recognition that taste does have a role, that good judgment does have a role, and that there is a role to play here that helps people address a controversy that needs at least understanding, at least discussion, debate, dialogue, and understanding, and it's that leads me to say, if I were there, I think I would be proactive in a way that would try to make a difference where no difference is being made.
I'd like to react to the question real quick. My reaction to the story you tell, the facts you related, is that it is simply one more example of the extent to which demagogues have always found it a very successful tactic, a very effective lever, to use the religious sentiments of the masses. And that is simply a sophisticated demagogue who has figured out how to stir up a particular segment of the world's masses.
But let me add, I mean, we certainly in this Christian majority country have our share of those.
You bet we do. When I said earlier, I said it's the mixture of religion and politics, not any given religion.
Gay, if I may just add a little bit about, to capture the sequence of events that what happened, as far as my understanding, was that the initial publication of this did not really incite any sort of response at all in Denmark. In fact, by and large, the Muslim population there ignored those. And then, of course, you had this small group of activists, or so-called activists, who now took that campaign to the east first. And immediately through some Arab satellite channels like Iqra and other things, and other channels of the sort, it was now aired. And so from then on, the Western media and the Eastern media both joined hands in sort of stirring up these sentiments in Muslims. And as that happens, then, of course, you have your other population now that was brought into the picture, that perhaps is this marginalized of society that is just waiting for something like this to happen. But by and large, many Muslims have chosen not to react to these cartoons, and still do not react to these cartoons, even here in the United States.
I have a question for the lawyer on the panel. Our Constitution supports the burning of the American flag. Does it support the burning of the Quran?
Absolutely. If it is a political or religious statement of opinion, it is absolutely protected. The burning of the Bible, too.
You had a question in front?
Both the Douay and King James Version.
I'm sorry, take your pick.
You had a hand up here, ma'am.
Me?
Yes.
A lot of times people take more, they get more sensitive around religious areas. Politics, however, has always been, in our country, an arena where it was always fair game. Islam, who the doctor told me once, is not just a religion, but it's also a political system. Now, my question to you all, whoever wants to do this, is in terms of our free speech, our being able to say anything to anybody or whatever, if you've got a religion and a politic that are very intertwined and meshed, how do we go about start separating the prisons out? Muhammad was a religious leader, he was also a political leader. If we want to take out after him as a political leader, can we not do that in this arena as, say, the religious leader? It gets very, as Tom said, when you put religion and politics together, you get a very strange mix.
So your question is, can you separate
In terms of our being able to speak out and say anything about anything, as we said, there's no hate speech, we have no hate speech. Religion gets very, people get a little touchy there, even with his Christ and all that. But still, politics is another arena, and we get in there, we bloody ourselves. So when you've got politics and religion that are intertwined, how do you go about doing something without, having everybody go sensitive and, ooh, you can't do that, and I'm really angry?
Well, obviously you're describing one of the, constitutional, great constitutional thorns of modern America, the word separation right there. I would tend to say that one way you resolve the dilemma is with a very strong view of free speech, as Professor McCoy, I think, amply articulated, that by viewing free speech as near absolute, that's one way I think you kind of finesse the dilemma. But as John Siegenthaler so eloquently describes, that doesn't alleviate gatekeepers of information like newspaper editors from obligations to be part of the community that they're serving as journalists. So you still have to make tough calls. You can't hide behind free speech, or you won't be in business as a newspaper person for very long.
One of the problems with regard to the differences in culture that are most worrisome to me relate to some of our Christian prophets and what they had to say about Muslims and their faith in the early days after 9/11. I mean, there were really outrageous statements made, and I'm sorry to say, not many people of faith countered what Pat Robinson was spouting on his Christian broadcast network. And you know, he went into such depth in describing what Muhammad really was about and what that religion was about. It went, we've all said, best answer to bad speech is speech. And it went almost unanswered. And I would have to say, looking back on it, it is still unanswered. If this outburst over these cartoons doesn't tell us anything else, it sure tells us that somebody had better, in our government or in our churches, better start explaining to the people of the Western world what this prophet was about and what his people are about. Because maybe the people in this room know, but there are many of us in this room who don't know and need to know.
You have a question on him?
Yeah, I was sort of a two-pronged question. One being, in the States and in America, we limit the publication of pornography. And how does that play the role of, in history, pornography has been a source of free expression and free speech. And that sort of ties into the well-being of the state. When you print something that's insightful, or when you print something that's unhealthy, is it the state's responsibility to step in and regulate it in some way, shape, or form?
I'd say absolutely not.
Yeah, I would say it even louder. Absolutely not. In fact, pornography is protected in the United States. That is, speech that has a sexual content. I think probably what you're thinking of is what the U.S. Supreme Court calls obscenity. But that is such a very narrow class of stuff that the court deems as totally without any ideational content whatsoever. No opinion, no view, no contribution at all to the marketplace of ideas. Not because it's a bad contribution, not because it's an offensive contribution, not because it's ideas that need to be suppressed, but no contribution at all. It is the equivalent of a mechanical sexual stimulator. And that is not protected by the First Amendment free speech. Now, I think it is not a limitation based on the offensiveness of the view being expressed. There are absolutely no limitations based on the offensiveness or obnoxiousness of the view being expressed. I don't think it's a double standard at all. The standard is if it has any ideational content whatsoever, if it communicates anything whatsoever, however obnoxious, it is absolutely protected.
And could I just, just as a journalist, when I think about our government, when I think about who's in our government, when I think about government being able to decide what is published about moral issues, I think a little bit about Bill Clinton. And how, if our society had evolved differently, the press under the government of one who was criticized for being immoral, stated plainly, would you really want the press controlled by one who would be led perhaps to defend himself under those circumstances? What makes the government better than the people in a government are the people? You know, that's an imperfect answer, I know, and maybe even an offensive one, but it does seem to me that the reason that First Congress approved the First Amendment was they didn't trust themselves with the power. Bruce and Tom might correct me on that, but it just occurs to me that they knew if they had the power, there wouldn't be much criticism, and there would be a lot of regulation, and they went a different way, and I think we're better for it.
Two more there.
Well, you know, the man who beats his wife said, if you hadn't burned the toast, I would have had to beat you. So if we hadn't, if
actually, my take on that is that the press in the United States is more confident in its free speech and free press rights than the European press is. And so the press in the United States does not feel compelled to test the limits or demonstrate gratuitously their freedom of speech, whereas my experience with France and Germany is that the press over there are not all that confident about their free speech rights, and so they almost protest too much. They are up against a judiciary in both France and in Germany that does, in fact, regularly restrict free press and free speech. And so I think this is an attempt by the European media to try to gain some free speech or demonstrate free speech, an impulse that the American media simply does not feel that strongly because they're more confident in their free speech.
But you know the public want to see these cartoons, and they're newsworthy, so why aren't we seeing the cartoons?
Well, can I don't know that I quarrel with Tom's view of the sort of American versus European press view of free speech, but I do disagree or depart a little bit in the sense that it's clear that huge swaths of the mainstream American press are intimidated by their business mission and by, you know, their commercial obligations getting in the way of their editorial prerogatives and obligations. I mean, there's no question about that. It's nice that John Siegenthaler, if you're running the Tennessean today, would run those cartoons, but it's hardly a surprise that a Gannett-owned Tennessean won't. We've seen some university papers run these cartoons. The most interesting example of an incredible cop-out on this issue that I saw was by a press outlet that I love and read almost daily, which is Slate, whose editor, Jacob Weisberg, was on an NPR piece in which he was asked, you know, well, is Slate going to put up these cartoons? And he was saying, well, unlike newspapers, we're a freewheeling, online, web-based form of journalism. We don't have the same kind of constraints. Oh, so you've posted the cartoons on Slate's website. Well, actually, no, we don't really want to be associated with them, so we'll post a link to a right-wing magazine that's actually he didn't use those words, but that's what they did. They posted a link to Human Events Online, a far-right magazine that printed the cartoon.
One last question. You've had your hand up for a very long time.
Yeah, I wanted to make what I think would be a slight correction about the Prophet Mohammed. At least I consider it a correction as far as restraint. Having read the Hadith by, that's the way you pronounce it, Muslim and Bukhari, the two most accurate guys, y'all probably know what I'm, well, the Muslims love it. Okay, having read those hadiths, having read Muslim scholars, having read Muslim historians, it's very clear and undisputable that on a number of occasions, the Prophet Muhammad sent out assassins to stab poets to death, both male and female, who had written poems ridiculing him. Now, maybe there's an explanation about that I don't know. That is, I think that's a fact that no Muslim scholar in any Middle Eastern university would deny.
Okay.
So I can see why there's this violent reaction.
Yeah. And you, that point relating to this issue is...
I'm saying it's okay tradition. To send out and stab people to death to write poems against him. Why shouldn't a typical Muslim who studies the Hadiths when he's grown up think it is okay to put these Denmark guys to death who put out the cartoons, and since they can't get to them up in Denmark, I can see how their frustration is boiling over. I don't justify it. Don't get me wrong. I don't agree with the teaching. I'm not surprised if they're just reacting to what I'm saying. A lot of people in this country are surprised. I'm not the least bit surprised.
You think it's a violent religion?
Oh, absolutely, John. Listen, John, let me tell you something.
Come on.
I'm shocked you
I mean,
right
come
now.
On. Let's get serious.
Mr. Second Thing. I'm going to shock you right now. The Muslim religion officially mandates the killing of any man who converts from Islam to another religion. Isn't that right, doctor? Isn't that right, professor?
You were asked, what does this have to do with this topic? You haven't answered that question.
He asked me if I thought Islam was a violent religion.
Okay, so...
Not for a moment do I believe it.
Okay.
And I not only don't believe it, I have heard Muslims, the vast majority of Muslims, speak out against violence again and again.
Most Muslims, I haven't been a Muslim in this town who thinks you should be killed for putting your quit in the modern ways other than a few in this class I took last year. But that is the official teaching. Half a dollar, John. That's official teaching. Half a dollar.
Let me ask you a question. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you a question. Do you speak Arabic?
No.
You read your books in English?
Yeah.
Then that means your understanding is weak and useless. That's it. Your understanding is weak and useless. Because these books were written in Arabic, and in the language of the Arabs, your understanding is deficient and weak. You don't have to come down here to talk to me about that any further. You can sit where you are. You can sit where you are. You can sit where you are. I can hear you where you are. You can go back and sit where you are.
Ask if there are any other questions.
Are there any other questions? Does anyone in the panel want to say a benedictory remark?
We got another question up there. We got another question up there.
One last question.
Oh,
yes.
It's just getting good.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say that I feel fortunate to be here and be able to engage in this kind of dialogue. And I also think it's interesting that insight and insight, CITESIGHT, are so close. And I think from incidences like this, we can learn something if we can look inside ourselves and create an open dialogue. I don't think this is about cartoons, and I don't think this is so much about free speech. You know, you can be against abortion and blow up clinics, or you can look, try to educate people. There are lots of ways to approach problems. And I think what we need to be discussing is the divide between the powerful and the powerless.
We will continue to talk about this. Thank you very much, all of you.
And thank you for having us.